Voice of the Cape, Drive Time, welcome to the show. It's that time of the week when we put our feet up and we talk about books. Today's book is entitled The Fall. The author is Jen Thorpe. Jen Thorpe is a feminist writer and researcher based in Cape Town. Her first novel, The Peculiars, was long listed for the Etty Salat Prize for Literature and the Sunday Times Fiction Prize in 2017. She's edited collections of essays, and the book now, The Fall, is at a shelf near you. I'm going to quickly read something from the back cover so we all are on the same page when we start to discuss this very interesting read. Hector, hashtag fees must fall, protest leader, believes it's time for the students to think a bit bigger than toy-toying. This creates problems for Noné, South Africa's president, who wants no trouble from pesky students in the week she's launching an extraordinary zoo. So, when Tuli reveals that she can see 7 days into the future and Hector's life is at risk, the idea seems only semi-crazy to Helen, the journalist she tells. But as Helen starts to investigate the sinister forces that lurk on campus, she realizes that Tuli only knows part of the danger. The people in power might be more menacing than anyone could have foreseen. One thing is certain, if Tuli is right, there are only 7 days to change the future. Set in an alternate Cape Town and told by a diverse cast of characters, The Fall is an enthralling, edge-of-your-seat read, and I will endorse that last sentence. But Jen Thorpe, welcome to the airwaves.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, a bit of a long read at the back of the book there, but that's the only way I can sort of enable the listeners to get their heads around what you've just done.
There's a bit going on.
Yeah, there's quite a lot going on. In fact, I made some notes about my read. I've got a bit of satire, a bit of political critique, a bit of George Orwell's 1984, a touch of paranormal, zombie cops, tea roofs, and suspense. It's a lot, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, our politics is a lot, so it felt necessary to try and work in a few creative elements there.
No, you certainly did. Now, when you sat down and the idea for a book started to sort of brew inside your head, is the book the result of what you thought was going to happen when you started?
So I started because I was a parliamentary researcher at the time of the Fees Must Fall protests, and I observed firsthand some of the ways that students were mistreated by the public order police and were also disparaged in our political discourse by members of parliament. And I was walking home from work the one day, and it was as though Tuli was speaking to me, you know, as if she was a friend. Her voice appeared in my head very clearly. And from getting home and writing down the sort of conversation we'd had, I know this makes me sound mad, don't worry, the conversation that we had had, I then began to think, okay, what is the point of these protests? And for me, they revealed very strong opinions from many people. The media had a strong opinion of what they meant. Politicians had an idea. The students themselves had a story that they were telling. And, of course, all of us at the time who were employed in the public service were watching them and thinking, you know, what does this mean, the real bringing of truth to power? So it turned out slightly different. When I first wrote Hector, for example, he was a little bit more arrogant than he is now. There's a lot more weaving of backstory and trying to make it clear that all of these characters that I've written do have complicated past and are complex people.
Yeah, I mean, as human beings, we are, I would say, complex by our very nature. Now, you've got a whole cast of characters, multiple characters, and when you wrote the book, it's like a tapestry. You use the consciousness of one personality, and then it leads to the next one, and then the next one. How on earth did you manage to sew it together without confusing yourself when you were writing it?
A huge amount of notes. I had a big poster on my wall with a character sketch of what happened to each character per chapter so that I would be able to follow along. I had a really lovely poster in one of the places where I was writing it and literally mapped what happened next for each one of them. So I think because there are so many, and there's also a huge round of a cast of background characters, I didn't want to get it wrong. And the main characters each have something very different. Each of them has their own personal fall within the story. And I think I kept that central to them so that I wouldn't lose the thread as I wove it all together.
Yes, I mean, also in the book, you've just mentioned to us that you were a parliamentary researcher and you use Parliament as one of your sets, I'll put it that way, and your understanding of some of the people that work in Parliament as journalists, so we deal with some of these people, and you sort of, you've here and there, I was thinking, but hang on a minute, I've met that person, so...
I didn't base my characters on any real person.
Obviously, yeah.
Obviously, it was a composite. But I think when you are, I mean, our politics are quite transparent in that it's clear that there's a lot of very strong egos at play. And when you are a background person, like a journalist or a public staff member, they sort of forget that you're there. And I think a lot of times you see more than they would really like to show you. And so I didn't want anybody to come across as, you know, blatantly malevolent or narcissistic, but those are some of the characters that you see when you're working in that space. So you may recognize some character traits, but certainly not any one person.
Yeah, in fact, just as a bit of a footnote, I always used to like get close to the bodyguards and melt in, and they used to tell us a lot of... Well, they used to talk to each other and then say things that we were not supposed to know. So they were always a good source of information, but they didn't realize it half the time. But looking at the book and the characters in it, is there a message that you wanted to get across? And obviously, the interview is difficult in the sense that I don't want us to give too much away.
Spoilers, yeah.
Because people have got to buy the book, haven't they?
Please go and buy the book. That would make me so happy. I think the message that I wanted to convey is probably two parts. The first is that the overarching narrative that we had at the time about who protests was a very problematic narrative. I think we're so used to seeing protests in South Africa that people assume that, you know, there's a certain type of person who just goes out and protests. And my experience of having been a protester, having been at protests and listened to the stories of people that are there, is that people protest as a last result. They have often made very reasonable, measured, and taken very reasonable and measured steps to have their problems addressed and have been met with force or rejection or ignorance or silence. So I think I wanted that to come across, that the people who are protesting are real people and that they have just causes that they're fighting for. And the second one was around money. I mean, I think we heard a lot at the time about the huge expense that it would be to provide a free education for people. And then at the same time, our politicians were building themselves fire pools and getting blue light brigaded around. And I think it's really important as South Africans that we pay attention to the money. I think we're getting better about that lately. But really that there is enough money in this country to make it a better place for every single person if you only pay attention to what's getting priority.
Absolutely. Now, one of the central characters is Nonne, the South African president. You made her a woman. And if everybody's listening to know, it's not Nkosi Zana Zuma. It's Nonne. All right.
No, it's definitely not. This is long before that even got on the table. I think that's the thing. A book takes a very long time to be written. This one was started in 2016. It's on shelves now, but it does take a long time. So this is pre-Nkosi Zana.
Yeah, no, it's not her. So no guilt there as far as that is concerned. But she's an interesting character, this South African president, because she doesn't trust her minister. She thinks they're all incompetent. And and so it goes on. And it's almost like a bit of satire, a bit of comedy in terms of how she doesn't trust anybody around her. Yet the one person she does trust ends up being a headache for her at the end of the day, not to give too much away.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the problem when your politics, when the politics of corruption is the norm, there is the risk that there isn't anyone to trust and that can make people paranoid. And that was something that I witnessed amongst some politicians during my time as a government staff member, that people were suspicious of the wrong people, for example, the media, the people who were trying to provide them with support, and not suspicious of a wholly problematic cast of characters. But I did want Nonne to bring a bit of relief, because I think we've all lived through a very difficult decade in our politics, and it felt like she needed to not be someone who was you know, obviously Jacob Zuma, or obviously another, you know, problematic politician, but a person who was flawed, and as much as she was frustrating, you felt a bit bad for her at times. So she was very fun to write, and it was really fun to make her a woman, because I think it's important for people to acknowledge as well that women can be as good and as bad as men. We're not necessarily going to get a woman president one day and everything's going to turn to perfect. We need to make sure that we have, you know, a president in place who's socially just for anything to change.
Absolutely. Now, where there are similarities in terms of what I would call the presidential personality, Zuma, his vanity project was in Kandla, which, as you say, had the fire pool and the 12 million rand chicken coop. Norne, on the other hand, has a zoo. Now, that's interesting.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it was very fun to write the creatures that appear in her zoo as well. I also wanted to do a little bit of commentary around our relationship in the BRICS partnership and how we sort of allies with some very problematic political figures at the moment. But Kandla provided a nice example of what you can spend your money on. And I thought, well, imagine if it was even more ridiculous. That's, I think, where the satire was fun, was pushing it to the extreme ridiculousness to show that actually what we already lived through was really crazy.
Yeah. No, I mean, there was a whale that had to have a special tank because if it made a sound, the glass would break. And many other interesting zoo animals which the readers must read about. But Norne seems to have had a bit of a crush on the Russian president, Vlad.
Sort of unrequited, or we're not quite sure whether the interest is reciprocated. I think when we see our politicians misbehaving, it becomes really hard for us to see them as people. It's almost like it's difficult to see your parents as people at times, because they're supposed to provide you with something, and when they're failing to provide you, that they lose their humanity in a way. But Norne has this unrequited love where you think, you know, there's all this other chaos going on, but what she's really interested in is a relationship, and, you know, she's lonely.
Yeah, and she drinks a lot of iced tea, doesn't she?
She does drink a lot of iced tea. It's very hot in KZN. I'm from KZN. So,
all right, okay.
I mean, you do need to stay hydrated.
No, absolutely. And, of course, I mean, there's a character called Miles, who everybody thinks is a male and turns out to be a female. I'm not going to go further than that. But Miles is one of the pivotal characters, isn't she, in the fall of Norne?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's interesting is that the plot is the protesters are the headache for her, but what is the headache really is her own ego, and I think that in the end becomes the destructive force that brings her down in a way.
No, absolutely. You've also got some interesting policemen. The journalist Helen discovers that the cops, it's not the Keystone cops, which is how our police normally behave in public, that these police, they're silent, they're quiet, they don't seem to be able to answer a question. But a bit of science fiction, surrealism coming in there, but it adds to the atmosphere of the story, doesn't it? It just gives a little bit of a sinister tint to happenings.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we've seen in the way that we tend to talk about our police these days is as though they're mindless operatives in some bigger scheme. But I really feel like what we need in our political analysis more is to humanize everybody. So when I was at Parliament, we were watching, you know, police push back students, and I was thinking, you know, these police themselves do not earn a good enough salary for the work that they do. Their children are going to struggle to get to university one day. And it becomes a hugely strange system where you have the oppressed policing the oppressed. So the police, the reason that I went speculative was to do a bit more of that commentary. Who are we using as bodies in our fight for, you know, to hold certain people back? And I think it was fun to create them and fun to think of a backstory that might make sense. But really the story is that our police in South Africa are both hugely problematic and hugely exploited.
No, because, I mean, you do it by making our police into zombies. I'm not going to give away much more than that.
Yeah, it's tough to talk about.
Yeah. Then you've got Thuli, who has what you call glitches.
Yes.
Where did you come up with the term to use glitch for somebody who could see 7 days into the future?
I don't know where I came up with that term, but I think the experience of seeing into the future, I've recently been thinking about the idea of being hopeful in South Africa, and I read a very useful quote that when you have despair, that's a form of certainty of future. It's a future memory that's certain. You assume things will always be as terrible as they are. But when you look forward with hope, you have a bit more of a flexible future that you can build. And I think with Thuli, she had this terrible experience which resulted in her being able to do this future seeing. And instead of, you know, giving into despair and, you know, not acting, she chooses to act, which I think is what hope allows you to do.
No, absolutely. And another interesting character is Hector, who is at the leadership of the Fees Must Fall. But what I find interesting here is that I'm sure you'd agree with me, like a lot of students were compromised when they started protesting because they had a lot to lose. They really did. And I think Hector is a classic case of somebody who had a lot to lose. And at the end, he finds himself very severely compromised.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the student protests were interesting in that they were the elites in some way of the people who had finished our education system. It's only around 13% of people actually qualify to go to university. So in some ways, the protest was an elite issue. But at the same time, we have a constitution that has a right to education. So in fact, the problem is that our education system doesn't produce more graduates. But Hector is compromised by... He really becomes compromised by his attachment to people and to wanting to do things that meet other people's needs. So has a romantic interest, for example, and that sort of sets him off, you know, puts him off course for a little bit, and he gets wrapped up with some complicated people. But at the heart of it, he really does want to bring a better situation for the students. And I do think that genuinely when those protests started, that was in the interest of the students.
With Hector, you introduce us to a very serious theme, and that is of gender-based violence. Some of the people hanging around Hector are guilty of raping one of your characters. Tell us about that. That's a serious note in the book.
Yeah, I mean, my background, the work that I was doing at Parliament, the work that I did until very recently was in the gender-based violence field, and it didn't feel right to write a South African story where that wasn't the backdrop, because for many of us, that is the background to every action that we take. And I think one of the things that's missing from our narrative is how to encourage men to have difficult conversations with their male friends about their norms, about their ideas, and about their behaviors. And so in the story, these friends of Hector's are rapists. They're very violent characters, but he doesn't know how to talk to them about it, and he doesn't know how to distance himself. And so he becomes compromised by that relationship, and it does affect people's respect for his integrity. And so I do think we, in a country like this, you have to talk about gender-based violence. I didn't want it to be a novel only about that, but it wouldn't have felt real to me to write it without that happening, unfortunately.
No, absolutely. Unfortunately, Jen, we have to leave it there. We could have carried on chatting until sunset about your book, but you have to get it. It's called The Fall by Jen Thorpe. It's Kwela Books, and I know it is at a bookshop near you. It's well worth the read. It's a beautiful South African story. It's got a bit of everything. As I say, it's got satire. It's got political critique. It's got some of George Orwell's 1984. It's got zombie policemen, a bit of paranormal suspense, and intrigue right until the last word. Jen Thorpe, everything of the best with The Fall. May it fly off the shelves.
Thank you so much.
Drive Time 91.3. Always on the cutting edge.